Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, and he's the co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture, and Afghanistan, a Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And this massive bomb that went off in a supposedly secure part of Kabul, I understand the German embassy and the Turkish embassies have been badly damaged, but also your officers of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, they were also affected, were they not?
Yes, they're about half a kilometer away, and according to our staff, while no one was hurt, all the windows were blown out, and some of our equipment was damaged. And people were psychologically very upset about this. This was trouble in Kabul. It was not unusual, but nobody had seen anything like this.
And I take it that the bomb was actually one of those sewerage trucks, those big tankers, that somehow got through a series of security checkpoints, leading some people to suspect that there might have been some collusion with the Afghan security forces?
There might have been collusion, but also this is a very heavily trafficked area. There's some parts of the green zone and elsewhere that that do demand special licenses or permits, and they turn people away. But this is actually a main public street that goes through. So while going through Kabul, there are many checkpoints which vehicles can be stopped. They're sort of largely stopped at the discretion of the police running those. And there's questions as to why they perhaps wouldn't have stopped a truck like that. It's not exactly like it's sort of a walled-off area. It's a major traffic thoroughfare in a rather crowded part of the city.
But are these trucks common that drain cesspools?
They're not all that common. You don't usually see that many on the street. Kabul is full of pretty much smaller cars. But it's also might not be that unusual either. For that part of town, it would certainly be unusual. There's not a whole lot of cesspools that are cleaned in that area.
So this, of course, is happening at a time when the U.S. military in Afghanistan, General Nicholson's calling for more troops, and apparently the Trump administration is mulling over the idea of putting in perhaps as many as 6,000 more troops to train the Afghan security forces. Boy, have we heard that refrain before. We need more time and more troops to train. I mean, at what point is this country ever going to be able to defend itself?
Well, it's under a great deal of pressure, but one of the things you have to remember is while they're calling for extra troops, a year ago they had more troops than that. The Obama administration goal was to get the troops down to zero. They decided that that was probably not the best strategy, so they stopped at 8,500, but they've been drawing down fairly substantially. So in some senses, this is more of a status quo ante of the where it was perhaps a year ago. So while it is a request for troops, those troops were there, you know, sort of 6 months ago. So, you know, it's the whole question is, what's the minimum of troops that you need? And while the Obama administration had said, well, we're only going to use the troops for training, in its last year, it had begun to use both special forces and army troops, not only to train Afghans, but to be on the front lines supporting the Taliban and allowing airstrikes to be called in. So to some extent, the description of American troops just doing training was, over the past 8 or 9 months, has actually sort of really not been the case. They've been involved in much more fighting on the ground, not necessarily as American units, but sort of backing up the Afghans.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the co-author of Afghanistan, An Atlas of Indigenous People, and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So you mentioned NATO, ISAF. The Turkish embassy was badly hurt, and so was the German embassy. And there's been an exodus of diplomats now from European countries. They seem to be pulling out one by one. And this could, on the surface, this is a vote of no confidence, surely, in the Afghanistan government.
Well, it surely is, and that's one of the things that Ashraf Ghani and his coalition really has to worry about. This was not so much a military attack as it was a political attack to sort of undermine confidence in the Afghan government. And there's a lot to be undermined, but in this case, it occurred in a symbolically a very important part of the city because it is the diplomatic quarter. And in most capitals, those are the areas that are most strongly protected. Not very far, maybe 500 meters from the beginnings of the palace complex itself. So you're within walking distance from the German embassy to get over to where Ashraf Ghani lives in his palace.
So do you think then that there's anything that can be done to staunch this if indeed there's an exodus underway? Of diplomats, that's a pretty strong statement. What do you think Ashraf Ghani can do?
Well, that's a really interesting question. His government has been rather dysfunctional and become more unpopular with the Afghan people, who had very high hopes for him when he came in. They've made some advances. The Vice President Dostam, who's reputed to have committed war crimes and was actually indicted by the Attorney General, and he's fled to Turkey. That's something new, to have sort of a bad actor leave the stage. They've also come to an agreement with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, also a bad actor, but one who's left the insurgency to more or less make peace with the government. So there's been some ups and downs in terms of what's been happening, but the government is not particularly functional at a time that it really needs to be. In terms of the diplomats, one of the things, the American embassy is very, very large. They're much more secure and better designed than the German embassy for this, but they can't leave. There's nothing for them to do. In some senses, the leaving of diplomats symbolically is very important, but they had very little to do there. A much smaller number is probably what's needed anyway. But it sends a strong message when countries feel it's unsafe, for their diplomats. But precisely because it's become unsafe, the ability to do diplomacy or do the outreach work, the Germans recalled a number of their aid workers and others, within the past year. So for them, this is just sort of another step.
So at this point, though, nobody has claimed responsibility. The Taliban have not, and they made it clear that it wasn't them. You mentioned Hekmatyar. Is Hekmatyar involved in this its situation? Because the last time, a couple of years ago, there was a big bomb that went off, and I believe that was the Haqqani network. And What's important about the Haqqani network is its close ties to the Pakistan ISI, the Pakistani military intelligence. And so the Taliban say they weren't behind it. Everybody blames everything now on the Islamic State, which seems an extraordinary exaggeration, given how little time they've been in Afghanistan to have that kind of traction. And the Taliban's at war with them in any case. Is it likely that this is the Haqqanis again, that this, at the end of the day, these are the Pakistan's fingerprints?
According to Afghan intelligence on the news wires today, they are accusing the Haqqani network of doing this. It's different type of vehicle, but the last similar sized explosion in a poorer part of Kabul occurred about 2 years ago, and that was traced to the Connie network. They're really large attacks inside Kabul, the sophisticated ones are the products of the Haqqani network. That's their specialty. Embassy bombings against India, truck bombing 2 years ago, and perhaps this one. Certainly the suspicion of the Afghans will be Pakistan may well have a hand in this. That's purely speculation at this point, but given the size of this, it's certainly much larger and more devastating than one normally sees in Afghanistan. And the fact that the Taliban were quick to deny that they had anything to do with this kind of shows that if you're running an insurgency, you at least seek some kind of popular support. This is going to have no popular support whatsoever. But to the extent that it shows the weakness of the Afghan government or Kabul, any country that's interested in sort of underlining that fact will consider that a plus.
Well, indeed, the religious authorities in Afghanistan came out against this bombing in very strong terms, particularly given that it happened in Ramadan. So,
yes, this is the holy month of fasting, so that's another strike against it.
So let's try and analyze the motives then of Pakistan. Many experts on the region say that almost every American death in that country can be, you can hold the Pakistanis accountable. They've armed, trained, and given shelter and directed the Taliban from day one, it seems. Although, as you just point out, there's some distance now. The Taliban aren't happy about this. So what would then Pakistan's motives be? Just to sow chaos? What is their end game? What do they want at the end of the day?
I believe they would like the foreigners to leave Afghanistan, to fall into chaos, and then their clients take over. What they want is a client regime in Kabul if they can get it. They sort of had that with the Taliban, and they lost it after 2001.
But who would their clients be? The Haqqani network? I mean, if the Taliban...
The Haqqani network is tools. They're sort of thinking of the Taliban... they would like any faction. During the Civil War, when the Taliban were taking over, the Pakistanis started referring to Afghanistan as their fifth province. And certainly, as we saw after 9/11 in Kunduz and other places, and during the war, Pakistan had direct involvement in helping the Taliban. They may have been secundered from their normal jobs, but they were directly involved. And as I say, they had achieved their strategic objectives with the Taliban. And after 9/11, that all fell apart, but they've never lost the desire to make Afghanistan their client state. And that means to have a compliant government in Kabul. But Kabul and Islamabad have always been sort of at odds with one another. It's a tough climb for the Pakistanis to pull this off.
But the thing that's so strange about Pakistan's duplicity here in basically stabbing the Americans in the back at every turn is that at the end of the day, if you have an unstable, lawless country, even if you got your clients in charge of it, doesn't that make the problem that the Pakistanis already have with the Pakistan Taliban even greater? Because you could have reverse sanctuary, surely.
Well, they already have that. The Pakistanis have already complained to the Afghans that the insurgents that they don't like, who have moved over to the Afghan side, they've been holding the Afghans responsible for that, saying, you're allowing insurgents to attack Pakistan. The Afghans, to some extent, is sort of turnabout is fair play. They don't actually support them. They don't control those areas, but they consider it a good deal of chutzpah for the Pakistanis to say, hey, there's guys on your side of the border that are attacking us, when for more than 10 years they've been doing that as policy. But you're correct. It's not a particularly rational policy. This policy has destabilized their whole frontier region. It created the Pakistani Taliban, who are more interested in deposing the Islamabad government than they are the Kabul government. This is all a direct byproduct of this. From a rational point of view, the consequences that Pakistan has got from trying to interfere with Afghanistan has actually been tremendously negative for Pakistan. Their civilian governments have recognized that. But for whatever reasons, their military has been wedded to this policy for a really, really long time, and trying to argue that actually creating instability is actually more dangerous for Pakistan in the long run than for Afghanistan would seem to be a good argument, but it's not one that's been readily accepted in Pakistan.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, what is the Trump administration likely to do? They're being pressured, or at least they're being requested, the military is requesting, at least General Nicholson in Afghanistan is requesting more troops. There have been some talk that the Trump administration are ready to dispatch more troops. I don't know whether you've seen this new Netflix movie starring Brad Pitt, which is based upon General McChrystal, but it's a devastating satire on the total absurdity of the American effort. And it ends up where it began. You know, McChrystal comes in, he's going to fix the problem and bring about peace and security and democracy in Afghanistan. And then at the end of the movie, he's done in, as we all know, by his own indiscretions. And then the new guy shows up, you know, this is like a clone of the McChrystal character, and we're back to Groundhog Day. And yes, it does feel like Groundhog Day, doesn't it?
It does, because, you know, people call it the longest war, but actually doing the same thing every year over and over again, it gets long, but, you know, there's sort of no progress in terms of thinking, what do you want, what do you want to do? And these disputes are not just military, they're political as well. The interesting thing on Afghanistan is I think Trump has essentially outsourced his Afghan policy to his generals. It's an area he seems to have no particular interest in. But all I think his concern would be, if it falls apart, he could be labeled a loser. And that's pretty strong on his mind. Obama faced the same problem. He could condemn Iraq as Bush's problem. But he took Afghanistan on. It's one of the reasons that Afghan policy sort of gets kicked down the can down the road, because presidents, they look what's happened in elsewhere, like Syria, like Iraq, and they say Afghanistan is bad, but it could be a lot worse. The interesting question that will come up is, will there be a change in American policy towards Pakistan? The military has always taken a much harder line than the State Department on Pakistan. Pakistan receives a tremendous amount of money still from the United States. It has the status of a non-NATO ally. Is this going to change? Actually, I could see more or less the status quo continuing in Afghanistan, but it's quite possible that there would be a major change in the policy on Pakistan, and that would have direct repercussions in Afghanistan, because certainly as far as the Afghans are concerned, the problem is more outside of Afghanistan than inside Afghanistan.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And he's the author of Afghanistan, a Cultural and Political History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.